This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson, visiting KMUW in Wichita.
Prohibition is a failure, as anyone can see. For whiskey is sold in every town in the good old USA. Oh, the policeman will arrest you, he'll lock you up in jail. He'll drink up all your liquor and turn you out on bail.
This month marks 100 years since Congress enacted the Volstead Act, the law that ushered in Prohibition.
With the bar lined with the boys and bums, spending their money, debauching their characters, rotting their bodies, and jeopardizing their immortal souls.
The national ban on alcohol lasted from 1920 until 1933, a so-called noble experiment that eventually collapsed as organized crime surged and even the non-criminals began to just willfully ignore it. To mark the 100-year anniversary, we're re-airing some of our most thought-provoking shows on drinking, sobriety, alcoholism, and everything in between. But first, let's explore the history of alcohol and America. Teresa McCullough is the curator of the American Brewing History Initiative at the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History. Teresa, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
First of all, Teresa, can I just tell you, I think you have one of the coolest jobs in the Smithsonian. Let's just nail that down right now.
I don't think I would dispute that.
What exactly is a beer historian? Talk about what you do at the Smithsonian.
So I am the curator of the American Brewing History Initiative, which is a project now almost 3 years old to build a new archive of the histories of home brewing and craft beer in the United States. And so when I joined the Smithsonian almost 3 years ago, I surveyed the collections that we had already related to brewing history and figured out how we could build on those collections to tell a story of the past and recent present.
Why look at America through the lens of alcohol?
Well, you know, it's an incredibly malleable, useful topic for a historian because beer and alcohol in particular run throughout the entire course of American history. And so really from even before the nation's founding, alcohol was present and important to the societies that existed here. It continues up until our present day.
Important just economically or also culturally?
Important economically, socially, culturally. I mean, beer in particular, you know, beer is labor. It's the history of technology, of agriculture, but it's also how we kick back and relax at the end of the day. It's how we end a day of labor, too.
One of the things that I think a lot of us learned from watching that Ken Burns documentary, Prohibition, which, by the way, if you haven't seen Prohibition, what are you doing with your life? Go find it and watch all three parts, is that alcohol and drinking were kind of part of America's early culture, part of the way that we kind of identified ourselves, and well before we were a nation, back when we were colonies. What was that identification?
Well, and even before we were colonies, fermented beverages were in use before European colonists arrived on this continent. And so from archaeologists and from anthropologists, we see evidence that indigenous communities on the continent were fermenting things like saguaro cacti and palms and fruits like plums and pineapples and using alcohol primarily for religious or ritual purposes. But when European colonists arrived on this continent and started to establish permanent settlements in the early 17th century, brewers were some of the first people who arrived on those ships because beer in particular and cider as well, those were considered much safer options to drink than water. But beyond even being a safe drink, we have evidence that Europeans didn't so much have a taste for water at the time. And so drinking beer was something that was considered truly nutritious and healthful, really a food product rather than just a drink.
Safer than water? How so?
Absolutely. Well, and so, you know, consider in the early years of American history and even European history at this point, we certainly don't have modern sanitation systems. And so beer, the process involved in making beer requires boiling. And so drinkers and brewers could not have understood this at the time, but the boiling involved in making beer rendered it a safer product to consume.
And so they never thought to just boil water.
Not quite yet.
So what would we as Americans or colonists have been drinking back when we were in the early, early days of this country or even before we were a country, when we were colonies?
Well, in the early 1600s, you have the first professional brewery established on this continent in Lower Manhattan in 1612, established by two Dutchmen by the names of Hans Christensen and Adrian Bloch. And they and the English settlers who followed soon after them were brewing ale styles of beer. And so if you think about about ales and lagers, those two great families of beer are distinguished primarily by the kinds of yeast that are at work in the brewing process. And so ales at this time produced a beer that was somewhat stagnant and heavy and opaque. And, you know, small beer was most likely consumed by Americans at the time. By small beer, I mean low alcohol beer.
And we're talking breweries, not distilleries, brewing beer and not like hard liquor, right?
That's right. And breweries at this time were really of a quite small scale. I mean, beer was a domestic product that was produced primarily by women and enslaved people at home. It was not practical to produce beer at a large scale in early American history. And again, we forget to some extent today that beer is, it's difficult to keep clean while it is brewing. You must have cool conditions to produce a clean product. And so in the early years of American history, it was just simply more practical to import beer from Europe rather than to produce it on a large scale here.
What was drinking like in terms of a daily practice? I mean, I remember in at least part of the documentary that, you know, there would be, you know, containers of cider or whatever the house was drinking kind of near the door that you could just kind of dip a mug into when you walked in. George Washington made sure that his troops were well supplied with some kind of alcohol during their hard campaign that I think it was Valley Forge. Like, how much was alcohol a part of day-to-day life?
Alcohol ran throughout day-to-day life for men, women, and children. And so if you're thinking of small beer and cider and also distilled spirits, things like rum or whiskey, rum being especially important because America was a colony tied to fellow colonies in the Caribbean, which produced sugar, whiskey, because Americans produced produced products involved in the making of whiskey. These were beverages that were drunk throughout the day, regardless of your age or gender.
We're speaking to Teresa McCullough, the curator of the American Brewing History Initiative at the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History. We'll have more with Teresa in a moment. Stay close.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Google. From Connecticut to California, from Mississippi to Minnesota, millions of American businesses are using Google tools to grow online. The Grow with Google initiative supports small businesses by providing free digital skills workshops and one-on-one coaching in all 50 states, helping businesses get online, connect with new customers, and work more productively. Learn more at google.com/grow.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, one of the hosts of On Point, the NPR show that takes you behind the headlines. We've done a deep dive series on education, and all episodes are available to binge now. Listen to On Point now on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
We're speaking to Teresa McCullough, the curator of the American Brewing History Initiative at the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History. Glad to get some of your comments and stories as well about how the history of alcohol intertwines with your history as well. Marilyn writes, in the late 1800s, my grandfather immigrated from Germany to Middletown, New York to start a brewery. Prohibition put him out of business. His motto was, King of all beers. Teresa, immigration is also very much tied into the story of alcohol, especially German immigrants.
Absolutely, yes. Our beer culture today is the result of our immigration history. And that's one thing that is so important for me to document and to speak to at the National Museum of American History. And so the first, you know, I just described this tradition of drinking ale styles of beer, but the first great revolution in American brewing culture as we understand it today came in the mid-19th century with the arrival of these waves of immigrants from present-day Germany and Austria and the Czech Republic. And among these immigrants came professional brewers, almost all men who were equipped and had the capital to establish professional breweries. And this was such an important shift because it brought brewing beer out of the realm of the home, out of the domestic sphere, into the American economy. And so producing beer became something that men could do for a profit. It took it out of the hands of women and of people of color working in homes across America.
And by the way, just to confirm, I just checked the transcript for Prohibition, and it does indeed say that it was at Valley Forge where George Washington did his best to make sure his men had a cup of rum every day and a cup of whiskey when the rum ran out. Now, there's beer and then there's beer, right? Is what we're describing historically when we say beer or liquor or whiskey or rum, is it an analogous drink to what we would get today, or were there any kind of key differences?
Well, the brewing landscape today is quite different. My focus at the Smithsonian, as I mentioned, is to collect the history of craft beer. And so we can speak about that a bit further. But today we're much more familiar with an amount of beer that varies greatly by style. You know, you can go to a supermarket and choose among IPAs or double IPAs or porters or stouts or what have you. But in the mid-19th century, what these immigrant brewers brought and what was so revolutionary to American drinkers was a new lager approach to brewing. And so they brought these different yeasts that worked on the bottom of fermentation vessels. This beer was aged. The yeast drew impurities down into the bottom of the vessels with it, and it left behind this very clear and effervescent and light beverage. And this kind of lager style of beer would be very familiar to American drinkers. In fact, it continues to be the favored style of beer among American drinkers today. And so we really can trace the stylistic heritage of the predominant popularity of American beer to this era from the mid-19th century onward.
We got some good questions about craft brewing, but I do want to talk about prohibition as well. I wonder when we talk about shifting views on alcohol, prohibition in the 18th Amendment and then the 21st Amendment is kind of the big thing we focus on. But how often have we shifted our views on alcohol? Was it just during prohibition, or were there other big moments?
Well, prohibition was when temperance advocates' work really came to a head, and several important factors converged to tip the nation into federal prohibition. But really, there have been movements advocating temperance since the nation's founding. There are the travel logs of visitors from Europe who came to the colonies and observed the proliferation of alcohol in the United States at the time. But it was really in the mid-19th century, in the late 19th century, that Americans started to look around, especially at the number of saloons that had popped up in cities throughout the country. And, you know, consider after the Civil War, this was the era of industrialization in the United States, and what better way to relax at the end of a workday than to spend a little bit of your extra change at the saloon. And so saloons were very much tied to the growth of American industry at this time. And so some Americans looked to the saloons and became quite critical of these places as sites of purportedly un-American social disorder. And it was this kind of criticism that came to a head with longtime temperance advocates that pushed the nation into prohibition.
Carmen writes, Utah is still flirting with prohibition, ironic since they were the state to end it. 4% alcohol by volume limit on draft, but starting November 1st, it goes up to, wait for it, a whopping 5%. You want some comical laws, check out ours. Got a lot of comments on Utah, and we'll get to that in just a moment when we continue with Teresa McCullough of the Smithsonian. I'm Joshua Johnson, and let's all raise a glass to 1A from WAMU and NPR.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from The Real Real, the leading reseller of authenticated luxury consignment. Shop luxury clothing, accessories, and fine art at unreal prices from your favorite designers like Louis Vuitton, Gucci, Cartier, and hundreds more. And The Real Real authenticates each item to ensure it's guaranteed authentic. Shop in-store, on the app, or at TheRealReal.com and receive 20% off select items with promo code REAL.
Hey there, it's Joshua. Thanks for listening to the 1A podcast. Please take a moment to subscribe and leave us a rating. That helps other people find the show. And don't forget, you can catch the news roundup at the end of every week.
This week on NPR's Rough Translation, the story of a 6-year-old military kid who moves with his family from base to base, never feeling like he belongs, until Tokyo.
Yeah, it's like I was Japanese, sort of.
Now his American mom has to figure out what she has to do to help her son fit in. That's Rough Translation from NPR.
This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Wichita, Kansas. We're discussing the history of alcohol in America with Teresa McCullough, the curator of the American Brewing History Initiative at the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History. We asked you to describe the state of your state's liquor laws, and to be honest, one state popped up in our voicemails a lot.
My name is Charlotte Dubiel, and I live in Salt Lake City, Utah.
My name is Casey, and I'm from Camas, Utah.
You asked about liquor laws and whether they make sense. Well, I live in Utah, so frankly, no, they don't.
Utah's liquor laws make about as much sense as a green sky.
I used to live in Washington State, where you could buy all of your wonderful wine and liquor in the grocery store. And then I moved to New York, which is a wonderful place to go out drinking and bring your children along. In Utah, you can't do any of that.
Any alcoholic beverage greater than 3.2% by weight, beer, wine, or liquor, must be bought, from a state-run liquor store. Utah has one of the highest alcohol tax rates in the country, making alcohol very expensive. All tap beer is 3.2% by weight, and a mixed drink is a measured 1 ounce pour. Happy hours are illegal, and you can only have one drink in front of you at a time.
Bartenders are not actually allowed to let you try anything. You cannot sample anything in Utah because every establishment pours through a monitor, and then the establishments get audited, and every single ounce of alcohol has to correlate with a charge to a customer. How interesting. Thanks so much.
So, Teresa, we heard about Utah's liquor laws. How do those kinds of strict regulations tie into prohibition, or are they more, let's say with Utah, a function of the state's history with the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the Mormons?
Well, I think with respect to Utah, it's a bit on both fronts, but this is just a fascinating example of how the repercussions of prohibition continue to be felt by us today. When prohibition was repealed by the federal government in 1933, one primary goal of repeal was to break up the lines of direct influence that had previously flowed between brewers or distillers and the public. And so the federal government created this three-tier system, inserting distributors into the mix and also giving states the power to figure out how they wanted to repeal prohibition themselves. And so Utah offers one interesting example, but you could also consider states like Mississippi or Alabama, where homebrewing was illegal until 2013, or even a much longer history of diverse aspects to curtailing alcohol production. And so Maine, for example, was the very first state to enact temperance legislation in 1851.
So temperance was a thing before it necessarily kind of turned into prohibition as a movement. Talk to us about what happened to brewers and drinkers during prohibition.
Well, prohibition was really completely devastating to the brewing industry, as you could expect. And so prohibition outlawed the production and transportation and sale of intoxicating beverages. Interestingly, it did not actually outlaw the consumption of alcoholic beverages. And so what this meant was that prohibition had very different effects for Americans of different social classes. And so if you were a wealthy American in the months or years leading up to prohibition, you could stock your cellar with what you enjoyed to drink and, you know, have a fairly good time throughout the dry years. But if you were of a lower socioeconomic class, that was not possible. And so Americans who were poor were the ones who tried to make liquor or beer themselves, and often did not have such good luck with that.
Could I back up one second? You mentioned that brewing in the United States originally was very much a small family thing. A number of slaves were brewers. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about the differences in experience that people of color may have encountered with alcohol? I just texted my mom because I remembered something about our family history, and she confirmed for me that her dad and her uncle had a juke joint and sold liquor and grew tobacco in northern Florida. Mm-hmm. Her uncles made moonshine. So I know that there's like a history of alcohol and tobacco economically in my family. Is that an unusual experience, or do people of color tend to have a unique history with alcohol in this country?
Well, they have been part of the history really from the start, but because people of color were excluded from more traditional historical narratives or from creating their own archives or historical collections, this is a history that's really being recovered by many scholars today. And so I'm glad you bring this up because there's wonderful new research that's coming out about the 19th century, the 18th century, the extent to which enslaved people were very much responsible for brewing the beer, not just brewing beer, but also cultivating hops and selling hops to planters. And so, for example, some recent research from Lee Graves, he's a Richmond-based beer historian, he has found records of planters, including Thomas Jefferson, purchasing hops from enslaved African Americans who were, you know, selling them for a profit at the time. But as we continue throughout American history, I mean, certainly the racism and discrimination that was endemic to all corners of American society, it was not absent from the brewing industry. And so people of color were excluded from sites of beer consumption. They were excluded from the work of beer and alcohol production, whether from unions or from producers themselves. And so it's a history that's a difficult one, but very important for us to understand.
Jessica emailed, "My grandmother told me stories about her mother and grandmother running moonshine stills in the woods behind their home in Wise County, Virginia. My great-grandfather was overseas in World War II, and they sold moonshine to get by. She said when the feds would come, their code was to call the chickens. Here, chick, 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 chick." The stills were eventually found and busted. Dan asks about hard cider. He writes, apples were originally grown for cider and not eating. Johnny Appleseed, a real person, established apple orchards all over the country and for the production of hard cider. When Prohibition arrived, thousands of orchards were chopped down, a great loss of the brilliant varieties that were discovered in the process of growing apples to make cider alcohol. Teresa, what about that? Cider, apple cider, as opposed to beer in the history of alcohol here?
Apple cider was by far the most prevalent alcoholic beverage in early America, actually. Cider was much easier to produce. It was much more likely to be consumed by early Americans than beer. As I mentioned, beer is quite difficult to produce, to keep clean, to produce a consistent product. And apple cider was by far the favored choice for Americans from the 18th century onward.
What about the future of this landscape? We mentioned craft beer has gotten more and more popular. Where do you see that trend going? And do we know what's driving it?
Well, and to draw back for one moment to your mention of Prohibition, mm-hmm. where craft beer began is very much actually in the legacy of Prohibition, that with Prohibition's repeal, we have a history of brewery consolidation in this country that continued from the 50s through the 70s. And it was consolidation in the brewing industry that produced an increasingly homogenous style of beer, this light-bodied lager that was originally so exciting to Americans. Ultimately, it came to seem a bit boring to some Americans by the mid-60s. And so it's the kind of narrowed stylistic diversity that resulted from Prohibition's repeal that compelled American homebrewers to start to tinker in the 60s and 70s to make more flavorful beers themselves.
One last question, Teresa. If you could go back in time and drink from any era, where would you go and what would you drink before I let you go?
I have to, in respect to my current position at the Smithsonian, I have to acknowledge this is a golden era for beer drinkers today. We have never had
very diplomatic.
More breweries in this country. We have never had a greater amount of creativity and diversity among the kind of beer that you could choose.
Right.
But, you know, if I had to select another era, I would consider, let's say, early 19th century, a beer that's brewed by a woman, an enslaved woman. Maybe it's a porter, something that no recipe exists for it. We don't know her name, but it was, you know, likely a product of the American landscape that was on the American table.
Teresa McCullough, the curator of the American Brewing History Initiative at the National Museum of American History. Teresa, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Today's episode was produced by Paige Osborne and Jonquilin Hill and edited by Miranda Fullmore. To learn more about them and the rest of our team, visit theoneA.org/staff. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening. This is 1A.